relationship. Whenever you can, bury the hatchet with an enemy, and make a point of putting him in your service. As Lincoln said, you destroy an enemy when you make a friend of him. In 1971, during the Vietnam War, Henry Kissinger was the target of an unsuccessful kidnapping attempt, a conspiracy involving, among others, the renowned anti-war activist priests, the Berrigan brothers, four more Catholic priests, and four nuns. In private, without informing the Secret Service or the Justice Department, Kissinger arranged a Saturday morning meeting with the three alleged kidnappers. Explaining to his guests that he would have most American soldiers out of Vietnam by mid-1972, he completely charmed them. He gave them some Kidnap Kissinger buttons, and one of them remained a friend of his for years, visiting him on several occasions. This was not just a one-time ploy. Kissinger made a policy of working with those who disagreed with him. Colleagues commented that he seemed to get along better with his enemies than with his friends. Without enemies around us, we grow lazy. An enemy at our heels sharpens our wits, keeping us focused and alert. It is sometimes better, then, to use enemies as enemies, rather than transforming them into friends or allies. Mao Zedong saw conflict as key in his approach to power. In 1937, the Japanese invaded China, interrupting the civil war between Mao's communists and their enemy, the nationalists. Fearing that the Japanese would wipe them out, some communist leaders advocated leaving the nationalists to fight the Japanese and using the time to recuperate. Mao disagreed. The Japanese could not possibly defeat and occupy a vast country like China for long. Once they left, the communists would have grown rusty if they had been out of combat for several years and would be ill-prepared to reopen their struggle with the nationalists. To fight a formidable foe like the Japanese, in fact, would be the perfect training for the communists' ragtag army. Mao's plan was adopted, and it worked. By the time the Japanese finally retreated, the communists had gained the fighting experience that helped them defeat the nationalists. Years later, a Japanese visitor tried to apologize to Mao for his country's invasion of China. Mao interrupted, "Should I not thank you instead?" Without a worthy opponent, he explained, a man or group cannot grow stronger. Mao's strategy of constant conflict has several key components. First, be certain that in the long run you will emerge victorious. Never pick a fight with someone you are not sure you can defeat. As Mao knew, the Japanese would be defeated in time. Second, if you have no apparent enemies, you must sometimes set up a convenient target, even turning a friend into an enemy. Mao used this tactic time and again in politics. Third, use such enemies to define your cause more clearly to the public, even framing it as a struggle of good against evil. Mao actually encouraged China's disagreements with the Soviet Union and the United States. Without clear-cut enemies, he believed, his people would lose any sense of what Chinese communism meant. A sharply defined enemy is a far stronger argument for your side than all the words you could possibly put together. Never let the presence of enemies upset or distress you. You are far better off with a declared opponent or two than not knowing where your real enemies lie. The man of power welcomes conflict, using enemies to enhance his reputation as a sure-footed fighter who can be relied upon in times of uncertainty. Reversal. Although it is generally best not to mix work with friendship, there are times when a friend can be used to greater effect than an enemy. A man of power, for example, often has dirty work that has to be done. But for the sake of appearances, it is generally preferable to have other people do it for him. Friends often do this the best, since their affection for him makes them willing to take chances. Also, if your plans go awry for some reason, you can use a friend as a convenient scapegoat. This fall of the favorite was a trick often used by kings and sovereigns. They would let their closest friend at court take the fall for a mistake, since the public would not believe that they would deliberately sacrifice a friend for such a purpose. Of course, after you play that card, you have lost your friend forever. It is best, then, to reserve the scapegoat role for someone who is close to you, but not too close. Finally, the problem about working with friends is that it confuses the boundaries and distances that working requires. But if both partners in the arrangement understand the dangers involved, a friend can often be employed to great effect. You must never let your guard down in such a venture, however. Always be on the lookout for any signs of emotional disturbance, such as envy and ingratitude. Nothing is stable in the realm of power, and even the closest of friends can be transformed into the worst of enemies. Here are further reflections on this law. From Dion de Poitiers. To have a good enemy, choose a friend. He knows where to strike. From Louis XIV. Every time I bestow a vacant office, I make 100 discontented persons and 1 ingrate. From Baldassare Castiglione. Thus, for my own part, I have more than once been deceived by the person I loved most, and of whose love, above everyone else's, I have been most confident, so that I believe that it may be right to love and serve one person above all others, according to merit and worth, but never to trust so much in this tempting trap of friendship as to have cause to repent of it later on. From Niccolo Machiavelli. There are many who think, therefore, that a wise prince ought, when he has the chance, to foment astutely some enmity, so that by suppressing it he will augment his greatness. Princes, and especially new ones, have found more faith and more usefulness in those men whom, at the beginning of their power, they regarded with suspicion, than in those they at first confided in. Pandolfo Petrucci, Prince of Siena, governed his state more by those whom he suspected than by others. From an African folktale, The Snake, the Farmer, and the Heron. A snake, chased by hunters, asked a farmer to save its life. To hide it from its pursuers, the farmer squatted and let the snake crawl into his belly. But when the danger had passed and the farmer asked the snake to come out, the snake refused. It was warm and safe inside. On his way home, the man saw a heron and went up to him and whispered what had happened. The heron told him to squat and strain to eject the snake. When the snake snuck its head out, the heron caught it, pulled it out, and killed it. The farmer was worried that the snake's poison might still be inside him, and the heron told him that the cure for snake poison was to cook and eat 6 white fowl. "You're a white fowl," said the farmer. "You'll do for a start." He grabbed the heron, put it in a bag, and carried it home, where he hung it up while he told his wife what had happened. "I'm surprised at you," said the wife. "The bird does you a kindness, rids you of the evil in your belly, saves your life, in fact. Yet you catch it and talk of killing it?" She immediately released the heron, and it flew away. But on its way, it gouged out her eyes. Moral: when you see water flowing uphill, it means that someone is repaying a kindness. From the Mahabharata. A Brahmin, a great expert in Veda, who has become a great archer as well, offers his services to his good friend, who is now the king. The Brahmin cries out when he sees the king, "Recognize me, your friend." The king answers him with contempt and then explains, "Yes, we were friends before, but our friendship was based on what power we had. I was friends with you, good Brahmin, because it served my purpose. No pauper is friend to the rich, no fool to the wise, no coward to the brave. An old friend, who needs him? It is two men of equal wealth and equal birth who contract friendship and marriage, not a rich man and a pauper. An old friend, who needs him?" From a Sufi proverb. Pick up a bee from kindness and learn the limitations of kindness. From Tacitus. Men are more ready to repay an injury than a benefit, because gratitude is a burden and revenge a pleasure. From Plutarch. Profiting by our enemies. King Hiero chanced upon a time, speaking with one of his enemies, to be told in a reproachful manner that he had stinking breath. Whereupon the good king, being somewhat dismayed in himself, as soon as he returned home, chided his wife. "How does it happen that you never told me of this problem?" The woman, being a simple, chaste, and harmless dame, said, "Sir, I had thought all men's breath had smelled so." Thus it is plain that faults that are evident to the senses, gross and corporal, or otherwise notorious to the world, we know by our enemies, sooner than by our friends and familiars. The third law. Conceal your intentions. Judgment. Keep people off balance and in the dark by never revealing the purpose behind your actions. If they have no clue what you're up to, they cannot prepare a defense. Guide them far enough down the wrong path, envelop them in enough smoke, and by the time they realize your intentions, it will be too late. Part 1. Use decoyed objects of desire and red herrings to throw people off the scent. If at any point in the deception you practice, people have the slightest suspicion as to your intentions, all is lost. Do not give them the chance to sense what you're up to. Throw them off the scent by dragging red herrings across the path. Use false sincerity. Send ambiguous signals. Set up misleading objects of desire. Unable to distinguish the genuine from the false, they cannot pick out your real goal. Transgression of the law. Over several weeks, Nenon de Lenclos, the most infamous courtesan of 17th century France, listened patiently as the Marquis de Sévigné explained his struggles in pursuing a beautiful but difficult young countess. Nenon was 62 at the time, and more than experienced in matters of love. The Marquis was a lad of 22, handsome, dashing, but hopelessly inexperienced in romance. At first, Ninon was amused to hear the Marquis talk about his mistakes, but finally she had had enough. Unable to bear ineptitude in any realm, least of all in seducing a woman, she decided to take the young man under her wing. First he had to understand that this was war, and that the beautiful countess was a citadel, to which he had to lay siege as carefully as any general. Every step had to be planned and executed with the utmost attention to detail and nuance. Instructing the Marquis to start over, Ninon told him to approach the countess with a bit of distance, an air of nonchalance. The next time the two were alone together, she said, he would confide in the countess as would a friend, but not a potential lover. This was to throw her off the scent. The countess was no longer to take his interest in her for granted. Perhaps he was only interested in friendship. Ninon planned ahead. Once the countess was confused, it would be time to make her jealous. At the next encounter, at a major fête in Paris, the Marquis would show up with a beautiful young woman at his side. This beautiful young woman had equally beautiful friends, so that wherever the countess would now see the Marquis, he would be surrounded by the most stunning young women in Paris. Not only would the countess be seething with jealousy, she would come to see the Marquis as someone who was desired by others. It was hard for Ninon to make the Marquis understand, but she patiently explained that a woman who is interested in a man wants to see that other women are interested in him too. Not only does that give him instant value, it makes it all the more satisfying to snatch him from their clutches. Once the countess was jealous but intrigued, it would be time to beguile her. On Ninon's instructions, the Marquis would fail to show up at affairs where the countess expected to see him. Then suddenly he would appear at salons he had never frequented before, but the countess attended often. She would be unable to predict his moves. All of this would push her into a state of emotional confusion that is a prerequisite for successful seduction. These moves were executed and took several weeks. Ninon monitored the Marquis's progress. Through her network of spies, she heard how the countess would laugh a little harder at his witticisms, listen more closely to his stories. She heard that the countess was suddenly asking questions about him. Her friends told her that at social affairs, the countess would often look up at the Marquis, following his steps. Ninon felt certain that the young woman was falling under his spell. It was a matter of weeks now, maybe a month or two, but if all went smoothly, the citadel would fall. A few days later, the Marquis was at the Countess's house. They were alone. Suddenly, he was a different man. This time, acting on his own impulse, rather than following Ninon's instructions, he took the Countess's hands and told her he was in love with her. The young woman seemed confused, a reaction he did not expect. She became polite, then excused herself. For the rest of the evening, she avoided his eyes, was not there to say goodnight to him. The next few times he visited, he was told she was not at home. When she finally admitted him again, the two felt awkward and uncomfortable with each other. The spell was broken. Interpretation. Ninon de L'Enclos knew everything about the art of love. The greatest writers, thinkers, and politicians of the time had been her lovers. Men like La Rochefoucauld, Molière, and Richelieu. Seduction was a game to her, to be practiced with skill. As she got older and her reputation grew, the most important families in France would send their sons to her to be instructed in matters of love. Ninon knew that men and women are very different, but when it comes to seduction, they feel the same. Deep down inside, they often sense when they are being seduced, but they give in because they enjoy the feeling of being led along. It is a pleasure to let go and allow the other person to detour you into a strange country. Everything in seduction, however, depends on suggestion. You cannot announce your intentions or reveal them directly in words. Instead, you must throw your targets off the scent. To surrender to your guidance, they must be appropriately confused. You have to scramble your signals. Appear interested in another man or woman, the decoy. Then hint at being interested in the target. Then feign indifference. And on and on. Such patterns not only confuse, they excite. Imagine this story from the Countess's perspective. After a few of the Marquis's moves, she sensed the Marquis was playing some sort of game, but the game delighted her. She didn't know where he was leading her, but so much the better. His moves intrigued her, each one of them keeping her waiting for the next one. She even enjoyed her jealousy and confusion, for sometimes any emotion is better than the boredom of security. Perhaps the Marquis had ulterior motives. Most men do. But she was willing to wait and see. And probably if she had been made to wait long enough, what he was up to would not have mattered. The moment the Marquis uttered that fatal word love, however, all was changed. This was no longer a game with moves. It was an artless show of passion. His intention was revealed. He was seducing her. This put everything he had done in a new light. All that before had been charming now seemed ugly and conniving. The Countess felt embarrassed and used. A door closed that would never open again. Observance of the law. In 1850, the young Otto von Bismarck, then a 35-year-old deputy in the Prussian Parliament, was at a turning point in his career. The issues of the day were the unification of the many states, including Prussia, into which Germany was then divided, and a war against Austria, the powerful neighbor to the south that hoped to keep the Germans weak and at odds, even threatening to intervene if they tried to unite. Prince William, next in line to be Prussia's king, was in favor of going to war, and the Parliament rallied to the cause, prepared to back any mobilization of troops. The only ones opposed to war were the present king, Frederick William IV, and his ministers, who preferred to appease the powerful Austrians. Throughout his career, Bismarck had been a loyal, even passionate supporter of Prussian might and power. He dreamed of German unification, of going to war against Austria and humiliating the country that for so long had kept Germany divided. A former soldier, he saw warfare as a glorious business. This, after all, was the man who years later would say, "The great questions of the time will be decided not by speeches and resolutions, but by iron and blood." passionate patriot and lover of military glory. Bismarck nevertheless gave a speech in Parliament at the height of the war fever that astonished all who heard it. "Woe unto the statesman," he said, "who makes war without a reason that will still be valid when the war is over. After the war, you will all look differently at these questions. Will you then have the courage to turn to the peasant contemplating the ashes of his farm, to the man who has been crippled, to the father who has lost his children?" Not only did Bismarck go on to talk of the madness of this war, but strangest of all, he praised Austria and defended her actions. This went against everything he had stood for. The consequences were immediate. Bismarck was against the war. What could this possibly mean? Other deputies were confused, and several of them changed their votes. Eventually, the king and his ministers won out, and war was averted. A few weeks after Bismarck's infamous speech, the king, grateful that he had spoken for peace, made him a cabinet minister. A few years later, he became the Prussian premier. In this role, he eventually led his country and a peace-loving king into a war against Austria, crushing the former empire and establishing a mighty German state, with Prussia at its head. Interpretation. At the time of his speech in 1850, Bismarck made several calculations. First, he sensed that the Prussian military, which had not kept pace with other European armies, was unready for war. That Austria, in fact, might very well win, a disastrous result for the future. Second, if the war were lost and Bismarck had supported it, his career would be gravely jeopardized. The king and his conservative ministers wanted peace. Bismarck wanted power. The answer was to throw people off the scent by supporting a cause he detested, saying things he would laugh at if said by another. A whole country was fooled. It was because of Bismarck's speech that the king made him a minister, a position from which he quickly rose to be prime minister, attaining the power to strengthen the Prussian military and accomplish what he had wanted all along, the humiliation of Austria and the unification of Germany under Prussia's leadership. Bismarck was certainly one of the cleverest statesmen who ever lived, a master of strategy and deception. No one suspected what he was up to in this case. Had he announced his real intentions, arguing that it was better to wait now and fight later, he would not have won the argument, since most Prussians wanted war at that moment and mistakenly believed that their army was superior to the Austrians. Had he played up to the king, asking to be made a minister in exchange for supporting peace, he wouldn't have succeeded either. The king would have distrusted his ambition and doubted his sincerity. By being completely insincere and sending misleading signals, however, he deceived everyone, concealed his purpose, and attained everything he wanted. Such is the power of hiding your intentions. Keys to power. Most people are open books. They say what they feel, blurt out their opinions at every opportunity, and constantly reveal their plans and intentions. They do this for several reasons. First, it is easy and natural to always want to talk about one's feelings and plans for the future. It takes effort to control your tongue and monitor what you reveal. Second, many believe that by being honest and open, they are winning people's hearts and showing their good nature. They are greatly deluded. Honesty is actually a blunt instrument, which bloodies more than it cuts. Your honesty is likely to offend people. It is much more prudent to tailor your words, telling people what they want to hear, rather than the coarse and ugly truth of what you feel or think. More important, by being unabashedly open, you make yourself so predictable and familiar that it's almost impossible to respect or fear you. And power will not accrue to a person who cannot inspire such emotions. If you yearn for power, quickly lay honesty aside and train yourself in the art of concealing your intentions. Master the art and you will always have the upper hand. Basic to an ability to conceal one's intentions is a simple truth about human nature. Our first instinct is to always trust appearances. We cannot go around doubting the reality of what we see and hear. Constantly imagining that appearances conceal something else would exhaust and terrify us. This fact makes it relatively easy to conceal one's intentions. Simply dangle an object you seem to desire, a goal you seem to aim for, in front of people's eyes, and they will take the appearance for reality. Once their eyes focus on the decoy, they will fail to notice what you're really up to. In seduction, setting up conflicting signals, such as desire and indifference, and you not only throw them off the scent, you inflame their desire to possess you. A tactic that is often effective in setting up a red herring is to appear to support an idea or cause that is actually contrary to your own sentiments. Bismarck used this to great effect in his speech in 1850. Most people will believe you have experienced a change of heart, since it is so unusual to play so lightly with something as emotional as one's opinions and values. The same applies for any decoyed object of desire. Seem to want something in which you are actually not at all interested, and your enemies will be thrown off the scent, making all kinds of errors in their calculations. During the War of the Spanish Succession in 1711, the Duke of Marlborough, head of the English army, wanted to destroy a key French fort because it protected a vital thoroughfare into France. Yet he knew that if he destroyed it, the French would realize what he wanted, to advance down that road. Instead, then, he merely captured the fort and garrisoned it with some of his troops, making it appear as if he wanted it for some purpose of his own. The French attacked the fort, and the Duke let them recapture it. Once they had it back, though, they destroyed it, figuring that the Duke had wanted it for some important reason. Now that the fort was gone, the road was unprotected, and Marlborough could easily march into France. Use this tactic in the following manner. Hide your intentions not by closing up, with a risk of appearing secretive and making people suspicious, but by talking endlessly about your desires and goals, just not your real ones. You will kill three birds with one stone. You appear friendly, open, and trusting. You conceal your intentions, and you send your rivals on time-consuming wild goose chases. Another powerful tool in throwing people off the scent is false sincerity. People easily mistake sincerity for honesty. Remember, their first instinct is to trust appearances, and since they value honesty and want to believe in the honesty of those around them, they will rarely doubt you or see through your act. Seeming to believe what you say gives your words great weight. This is how Iago deceived and destroyed Othello. Given the depth of his emotions, the apparent sincerity of his concerns about Desdemona's supposed infidelity, how could Othello distrust him? This is also how the great con artist Yellow Kid Wile pulled the wool over Sucker's eyes, seeming to believe so deeply in the decoyed object he was dangling in front of them, a phony stock, a touted racehorse, he made its reality hard to doubt. It is important, of course, not to go too far in this area. Sincerity is a tricky tool. Appear overpassionate and you raise suspicions. Be measured and believable, or your ruse will seem the put-on that it is. To make your false sincerity an effective weapon in concealing your intentions, espouse a belief in honesty and forthrightness as important social values. Do this as publicly as possible. Emphasize your position on this subject by occasionally divulging some heartfelt thought, though only one that is actually meaningless or irrelevant, of course. Napoleon's minister Talleyrand was a master at taking people into his confidence by revealing some apparent secret. This feigned confidence, a decoy, would then elicit a real confidence on the other person's part. Remember, the best deceivers do everything they can to cloak their roguish qualities. They cultivate an air of honesty in one area to disguise their dishonesty in others. Honesty is merely another decoy in their arsenal of weapons. Part 2. Use smokescreens to disguise your actions. Deception is always the best strategy, but the best deceptions require a screen of smoke to distract people's attention from your real purpose. The bland exterior, like the unreadable poker face, is often the perfect smokescreen, hiding your intentions behind the comfortable and familiar. If you lead the sucker down a familiar path, he won't catch on when you lead him into a trap. Observance of the law, number one. In 1910, a Mr. Sam Giesel of Chicago sold his warehouse business for close to $1 million. He settled down to semi-retirement and the managing of his many properties. But deep inside, he itched for the old days of deal-making. One day, a young man named Joseph Weil visited his office, wanting to buy an apartment he had up for sale. Giesel explained the terms. The price was $8,000, but he only required a down payment of $2,000. Weil said he would sleep on it. But he came back the following day and offered to pay the full $8,000 in cash, if Giesel could wait a couple of days until a deal Weil was working on came through. Even in semi-retirement, a clever businessman like Giesel was curious as to how Weil would be able to come up with so much cash, roughly $150,000 today, so quickly. Weil seemed reluctant to say, and quickly changed the subject. But Giesel was persistent. Finally, after assurances of confidentiality, Weil told Giesel the following story. Weil's uncle was the secretary to a coterie of multimillionaire financiers. These wealthy gentlemen had purchased a hunting lodge in Michigan 10 years ago at a cheap price. They hadn't used the lodge for a few years, so they had decided to sell it and had asked Weil's uncle to get whatever he could for it. For reasons, good reasons of his own, the uncle had been nursing a grudge against the millionaires for years. This was his chance to get back at them. He would sell the property for $35,000 to a setup man, whom it was Weil's job to find. The financiers were too wealthy to worry about this low price. The setup man would then turn around and sell the property again for its real price, around $155,000. The uncle, Weil, and the third man would split the profits from this second sale. It was all legal and for a good cause, the uncle's just retribution. Giesel had heard enough. He wanted to be the setup buyer. Weil was reluctant to involve him, but Giesel wouldn't back down. The idea of a large profit plus a little adventure had him champing at the bit. Weil explained that Giesel would have to put up the $35,000 in cash to bring the deal off. Giesel, a millionaire, said he could get the money with a snap of his fingers. Weil finally relented and agreed to arrange a meeting between the uncle, Giesel, and the financiers in the town of Galesburg, Illinois. On the train ride to Galesburg, Giesel met the uncle, an impressive man with whom he avidly discussed business. Weil also brought along a companion, a somewhat paunchy man named George Gross. Weil explained to Giesel that he himself was a boxing trainer, that Gross was one of the promising prize fighters he trained, and that he had asked Gross to come along to make sure the fighters stayed in shape. For a promising fighter, Gross was unimpressive looking. He had gray hair and a beer belly. But Giesel was so excited about the deal that he didn't really think about the man's flabby appearance. Once in Galesburg, Weil and his uncle went to fetch the financiers, while Giesel waited in a hotel room with Gross, who promptly put on his boxing trunks. As Giesel half-watched, Gross began to shadowbox. Distracted as he was, Giesel ignored how badly the boxer wheezed after a few minutes of exercise, although his style seemed real enough. An hour later, Weil and his uncle reappeared with the financiers, an impressive, intimidating group of men, all wearing fancy suits. The meeting went well, and the financiers agreed to sell the lodge to Giesel, who had already had the $35,000 wired to a local bank. This minor business now settled, the financiers sat back in their chairs and began to banter about high finance, throwing out the name of J.P. Morgan as if they knew the man. Finally, one of them noticed a boxer in the corner of the room. Weil explained what he was doing there. The financier countered that he too had a boxer in his entourage, whom he named. Weil laughed brazenly and exclaimed that his man could easily knock out their man. Conversation escalated into argument. In the heat of passion, Weil challenged the man to a bet. The financiers eagerly agreed and left to get their man ready for a fight the next day. As soon as they had left, the uncle yelled at Weil, right in front of Giesel. They did not have enough money to bet with, and once the financiers discovered this, the uncle would be fired. Weil apologized for getting him in this mess, but he had a plan. He knew the other boxer well, and with a little bribe, they could fix the fight. But where would the money come from for the bet? The uncle replied. Without it, they were as good as dead. Finally, Giesel had heard enough. Unwilling to jeopardize his deal with any ill will, he offered his own $35,000 cash for part of the bet. Even if he lost that, he would wire for more money and still make a profit on the sale of the lodge. The uncle and nephew thanked him. With their own $15,000 and Giesel's $35,000, they would manage to have enough for the bet. That evening, as Giesel watched the two boxers rehearse the fix in the hotel room, his mind reeled at the killing he was going to make from both the boxing match and the sale of the lodge. The fight took place in a gym the next day. Weil handled the cash, which was placed for security in a locked box. Everything was proceeding as planned in the hotel room. The financiers were looking glum at how badly their fighter was doing, and Giesel was dreaming about the easy money he was about to make. Then suddenly a wild swing by the financier's fighter caught Gross hard in the face, knocking him down. When he hit the canvas, blood spurted from his mouth. He coughed, then lay still. One of the financiers, a former doctor, checked his pulse. He was dead. The millionaires panicked. Everyone had to get out before the police arrived. They could all be charged with murder. Terrified, Giesel hightailed it out of the gym and back to Chicago, leaving behind his $35,000, which he was only too glad to forget. For it seemed a small price to pay to avoid being implicated in a crime. He never wanted to see Weil or any of the others again. After Giesel scurried out, Gross stood up under his own steam. The blood that had spurted from his mouth came from a ball filled with chicken blood and hot water that he had hidden in his cheek. The whole affair had been masterminded by Weil, better known as the Yellow Kid, one of the most creative con artists in history. Weil split the $35,000 with the financiers and the boxers, all fellow con artists. A nice little profit for a few days' work. Interpretation. The Yellow Kid had staked out Giesel as the perfect sucker long before he set up the con. He knew the boxing match scam would be the perfect ruse to separate Giesel from his money quickly and definitively. But he also knew that if he had begun by trying to interest Giesel in the boxing match, he would have failed miserably. He had to conceal his intentions and switch attention, create a smokescreen, in this case, the sale of the lodge. On the train ride and in the hotel room, Giesel's mind had been completely occupied with the pending deal, the easy money, the chance to hobnob with wealthy men. He had failed to notice that Gross was out of shape and middle-aged at best. Such is the distracting power of a smokescreen. Engrossed in the business deal, Giesel's attention was easily diverted to the boxing match, but only at a point when it was already too late for him to notice the details that would have given Gross away. The match, after all, now depended on a bribe rather than on the boxer's physical condition. And Giesel was so distracted at the end by the illusion of the boxer's death that he completely forgot about his money. Learn from the Yellow Kid. The familiar, inconspicuous front is the perfect smokescreen. Approach your mark with an idea that seems ordinary enough. A business deal, a financial intrigue. The sucker's mind is distracted, his suspicions allayed. That is when you gently guide him onto the second path, the slippery slope, down which he slides helplessly into your trap.
Observance of the Law, Number 2. In the mid-1920s, the powerful warlords of Ethiopia were coming to the realization that a young man of the nobility named Haile Selassie, also known as Ras Tafari, was out-competing them all, and nearing the point where he could proclaim himself their leader, unifying the country for the first time in decades. Most of his rivals couldn't understand how this wispy, quiet, mild-mannered man had been able to take control.
Yet in 1927, Selassie was able to summon the warlords, one at a time, to come to Addis Ababa to declare their loyalty and recognize him as leader. Some hurried, some hesitated. But only one, Djazmach Balcha of Sidamo, dared defy Selassie totally. A blustery man, Balcha was a great warrior, and he considered the new leader weak and unworthy. He pointedly stayed away from the capital. Finally, Selassie, in his gentle but stern way, commanded Balcha to come. The warlord decided to obey, but in doing so, he would turn the tables on this pretender to the Ethiopian throne. He would come to Addis Ababa at his own speed, and with an army of 10,000 men. A force large enough to defend himself, perhaps even start a civil war. Stationing this formidable force in a valley 3 miles from the capital, he waited, as a king would. Selassie would have to come to him. Selassie did indeed send emissaries, asking Balcha to attend an afternoon banquet in his honor. But Balcha, no fool, knew history. He knew that previous kings and lords of Ethiopia had used banquets as a trap. Once he was there and full of drink, Selassie would have him arrested or murdered. To signal his understanding of the situation, he agreed to come to the banquet if only he could bring his personal bodyguard, 600 of his best soldiers, all armed and ready to defend him and themselves. To Balcha's surprise, Selassie answered with the utmost politeness that he would be honored to play host to such warriors. On the way to the banquet, Balcha warned his soldiers not to get drunk and to be on their guard. When they arrived at the palace, Selassie was his charming best. He deferred to Balcha, treated him as if he desperately needed his approval and cooperation. But Balcha refused to be charmed, and he warned Selassie that if he did not return to his camp by nightfall, his army had orders to attack the capital. Selassie reacted as if hurt by his mistrust. Over the meal, when it came time for the traditional singing of songs in honor of Ethiopia's leaders, he made a point of allowing only songs honoring the warlord of Sidamo. It seemed to Balcha that Selassie was scared, intimidated by this great warrior who could not be outwitted. Sensing the change, Balcha believed that he would be the one to call the shots in the days to come. At the end of the afternoon, Balcha and his soldiers began their march back to camp amidst cheers and gun salutes. Looking back to the capital over his shoulder, he planned his strategy. How his own soldiers would march through the capital in triumph within weeks, and Selassie would be put in his place being either prison or death. When Balcha came in sight of his camp, however, he saw that something was terribly wrong. Where before there had been colorful tents stretching as far as the eye could see, now there was nothing, only smoke from doused fires. What devil's magic was this? A witness told Balcha what had happened. During the banquet, a large army, commanded by an ally of Selassie's, had stolen up on Balcha's encampment by a side route he hadn't seen. This army hadn't come to fight, however. Knowing that Balcha would have heard a noisy battle and hurried back with his 600-man bodyguard, Selassie had armed his own troops with baskets of gold and cash. They had surrounded Balcha's army and proceeded to purchase every last one of their weapons. Those who refused were easily intimidated. Within a few hours, Balcha's entire force had been disarmed and scattered in all directions. Realizing his danger, Balcha decided to march south with his 600 soldiers to regroup. But the same army that had disarmed his soldiers blocked his way. The other way out was to march on the capital, but Selassie had set a large army to defend it. Like a chess player, he had predicted Balcha's moves and had checkmated him. For the first time in his life, Balcha surrendered. To repent his sins of pride and ambition, he agreed to enter a monastery. Interpretation. Throughout Selassie's long reign, no one could quite figure him out. Ethiopians liked their leaders fierce, but Selassie, who wore the front of a gentle, peace-loving man, lasted longer than any of them. Never angry or impatient, he lured his victims with sweet smiles, lulling them with charm and obsequiousness before he attacked. In the case of Balcer, Selassie played on the man's wariness, his suspicion that the banquet was a trap, which in fact it was, but not the one he expected. Selassie's way of allaying Balcer's fears, letting him bring his bodyguard to the banquet, giving him top billing there, making him feel in control, created a thick smokescreen, concealing the real action 3 miles away. Remember, the paranoid and wary are often the easiest to deceive. Win their trust in one area, and you have a smokescreen that blinds their view in another, letting you creep up and level them with a devastating blow. A helpful or apparently honest gesture, or one that implies the other person's superiority, these are perfect diversionary devices. Properly set up, the smokescreen is a weapon of great power. It enabled the gentle Selassie to totally destroy his enemy without firing a single bullet. Balcer of Sidamo's last words before entering the monastery? Do not underestimate the power of Tufari. He creeps like a mouse, but he has jaws like a lion. Keys to power. If you believe that deceivers are colorful folk who mislead with elaborate lies and tall tales, you are greatly mistaken. The best deceivers utilize a bland and inconspicuous front that calls no attention to themselves. They know that extravagant words and gestures immediately raise suspicion. Instead, they envelop their mark in the familiar, the banal, the harmless. In Yellow Kid Wiles' dealings with Sam Giesel, the familiar was a business deal. In the Ethiopian case, it was Selassie's misleading obsequiousness, exactly what Balcer would have expected from a weaker warlord. Once you have lulled your sucker's attention with the familiar, they won't notice the deception being perpetrated behind their backs. This derives from a simple truth. People can only focus on one thing at a time. It is really too difficult for them to imagine that the bland and harmless person they are dealing with is simultaneously setting up something else. The grayer and more uniform the smoke in your smokescreen, the better it conceals your intentions. In the decoy and red herring devices discussed in Part 1, you actively distract people. In the smokescreen, you lull your victims, drawing them into your web. Because it is so hypnotic, this is often the best way of concealing your intentions. The simplest form of smokescreen is facial expression. Behind a bland, unreadable exterior, all sorts of mayhem can be planned, without detection. This is a weapon that the most powerful men in history have learned to perfect. It was said that no one could read Franklin D. Roosevelt's face. Baron James Rothschild made a lifelong practice of disguising his real thoughts behind bland smiles and nondescript looks. Stendhal wrote of Talleyrand, "Never was a face less of a barometer." Henry Kissinger would bore his opponents around the negotiating table to tears with his monotonous voice, his blank look, his endless recitation of details. Then, as their eyes glazed over, he would suddenly hit them with a list of bold terms. Caught off guard, they would be easily intimidated. As one poker manual explains it, while playing his hand, the good player is seldom an actor. Instead, he practices a bland behavior that minimizes readable patterns, frustrates and confuses opponents, permits greater concentration. An adaptable concept, the smokescreen can be practiced on a number of levels, all playing on the psychological principles of distraction and misdirection. One of the most effective smokescreens is the noble gesture. People want to believe apparently noble gestures are genuine, for the belief is pleasant. They rarely notice how deceptive these gestures can be. The art dealer, Joseph Duveen, was once confronted with a terrible problem. The millionaires who had paid so dearly for Duveen's paintings were running out of wall space, and with inheritance taxes getting ever higher, it seemed unlikely that they would keep buying. The solution was the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., which Duveen helped create in 1937 by getting Andrew Mellon to donate his collection to it. The National Gallery was the perfect front for Duveen. In one gesture, his clients avoided taxes, cleared wall space for the new purchases, and reduced the number of paintings on the market, maintaining the upward pressure on their prices. All this while donors created the appearance of being public benefactors. Another effective smokescreen is the pattern, the establishment of a series of actions that seduce the victim into believing you will continue in the same way. The pattern plays on the psychology of anticipation. Our behavior conforms to patterns, or so we like to think. In 1878, the American robber baron Jay Gould created a company that began to threaten the monopoly of the telegraph company, Western Union. The directors of Western Union decided to buy Gould's company up. They had to spend a hefty sum, but they figured they had managed to rid themselves of an irritating competitor. A few months later, though, Gould was at it again, complaining that he had been treated unfairly. He started up a second company to compete with Western Union and its new acquisition. The same thing happened again. Western Union bought him out to shut him up. Soon the pattern began for a third time, but now Gould went for the jugular. He suddenly staged a bloody takeover struggle and managed to gain complete control of Western Union. He had established a pattern that had tricked the company's directors into thinking his goal was to be bought out at a handsome rate. Once they paid him off, they relaxed and failed to notice that he was actually playing for higher stakes. The pattern is powerful in that it deceives the other person into expecting the opposite of what you're really doing. Another psychological weakness on which to construct a smokescreen is the tendency to mistake appearances for reality. The feeling that if someone seems to belong to your group, their belonging must be real. This habit makes the seamless blend a very effective front. The trick is simple. You simply blend in with those around you. The better you blend, the less suspicious you become. During the Cold War of the 1950s and 60s, as is now notorious, a slew of British civil servants passed secrets to the Soviets. They went undetected for years because they were apparently decent chaps, had gone to all the right schools, and fit the old boy network perfectly. Blending in is the perfect smokescreen for spying. The better you do it, the better you can conceal your intentions. Remember, it takes patience and humility to dull your brilliant colors, to put on the mask of the inconspicuous. Do not despair at having to wear such a bland mask. It is often your unreadability that draws people to you and makes you appear a person of power. Reversal. No smokescreen, red herring, false sincerity, or any other diversionary device will succeed in concealing your intentions if you already have an established reputation for deception. And as you get older and achieve success, it often becomes increasingly difficult to disguise your cunning. Everyone knows you practice deception. Persist in playing naive, and you run the risk of seeming the rankest hypocrite, which will severely limit your room to maneuver. In such cases, it is better to own up, to appear the honest rogue, or better, the repentant rogue. Not only will you be admired for your frankness, but, most wonderful and strange of all, you will be able to continue your stratagem. As P.T. Barnum, the 19th century king of humbuggery, grew older, he learned to embrace his reputation as a grand deceiver. At one point he organized a buffalo hunt in New Jersey, complete with Indians and a few imported buffalo. He publicized the hunt as genuine, but it came off as so completely fake that the crowd, instead of getting angry and asking for their money back, was greatly amused. They knew Barnum pulled tricks all the time. That was the secret of his success, and they loved him for it. Learning a lesson from this affair, Barnum stopped concealing all of his devices, even revealing his deceptions in a tell-all autobiography. As Kierkegaard wrote, "The world wants to be deceived." Finally, although it is wiser to divert attention from your purposes by presenting a bland, familiar exterior, there are times when the colorful, conspicuous gesture is the right diversionary tactic. The great charlatan mountebanks of 17th and 18th century Europe used humor and entertainment to deceive their audiences. Dazzled by a great show, the public wouldn't notice the charlatan's real intentions. Thus, the star charlatan himself would appear in town in a night-black coach drawn by black horses. Clowns, tightrope walkers, and star entertainers would accompany him, pulling people into his demonstrations of elixirs and quack potions. The charlatan made entertainment seem like the business of the day. The business of the day was actually the sale of the elixirs and quack potions. Spectacle and entertainment, clearly, are excellent devices to conceal your intentions, but they cannot be used indefinitely. The public grows tired and suspicious, and eventually catches on to the trick. And indeed the charlatans had to move quickly from town to town before word spread that the potions were useless and the entertainment a trick. Powerful people with bland exteriors, on the other hand, the Talleyrands, the Rothschilds, the Selassies, can practice their deceptions in the same place throughout their lifetimes. Their act never wears thin and rarely causes suspicion. The colorful smokescreen should be used cautiously, then, and only when the occasion is right. Here are some further reflections on this law. From the Old Testament, 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 18 through 28. Jehu, king of Israel, feigns worship of the idol Baal. Then Jehu assembled all the people and said to them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much more. Now therefore call to me all the prophets of Baal, all his worshippers and all his priests. Let none be missing, for I have a great sacrifice to offer to Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live. But Jehu did it with cunning, in order to destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu ordered, Sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal. So they proclaimed it. And Jehu sent throughout all Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And they entered the house of Baal, and the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. Then Jehu went into the house of Baal, and he said to the worshippers of Baal, Search, and see that there is no servant of the Lord here among you, but only the worshippers of Baal. Then he went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. Now Jehu had stationed 80 men outside and said, The man who allows any of those whom I give into your hands to escape shall forfeit his life. So as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guard and to the officers, Go in and slay them. Let not a man escape. So when they put them to the sword, the guard and the officers cast them out and went into the inner room of the house of Baal, and they brought out the pillar that was in the house of Baal and burned it. And they demolished the pillar of Baal and demolished the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Thus Jehu wiped out Baal from Israel. This from the 36 strategies quoted in the Japanese Art of War, Thomas Cleary. Sneak across the ocean in broad daylight. This means to create a front that eventually becomes imbued with an atmosphere or impression of familiarity, within which the strategist may maneuver unseen, while all eyes are trained to see obvious familiarities. The fourth law. Always say less than necessary. Judgment. When you are trying to impress people with words, the more you say, the more common you appear, and the less in control. Even if you are saying something banal, it will seem original if you make it vague, open-ended, and sphinx-like. Powerful people impress and intimidate by saying less. The more you say, the more likely you are to say something foolish. Transgression of the law. Gnaeus Marcius, also known as Coriolanus, was a great military hero of ancient Rome. In the first half of the 5th century B.C., he won many important battles, saving the city from calamity time and time again. Because he spent most of his time on the battlefield, few Romans knew him personally, making him something of a legendary figure. In 454 B.C., Coriolanus decided it was time to exploit his reputation and enter politics. He stood for election to the high rank of consul. Candidates for this position traditionally made a public address early in the race, and when Coriolanus came before the people, he began by displaying the dozens of scars he had accumulated over 17 years of fighting for Rome. Few in the crowd really heard the lengthy speech that followed,
Those scars, proof of his valor and patriotism, moved the people to tears. Coriolanus's election seemed certain. When the polling day arrived, however, Coriolanus made an entry into the forum, escorted by the entire Senate and by the city's patricians and aristocracy. The common people who saw this were disturbed by such a blustering show.